as if he and Aldrin might descend to the craters in beach clothes and get a suntan. As he looked out, Armstrong wondered where he and Aldrin had landed. With the distraction of the computer alarms, he'd missed all his checkpoints on the way down. Now he searched the horizon for some feature he might be able to identify, but found none. With a wry smile, he radioed Houston. "The guys who said we wouldn't know where we were are the winners today." He knew there must be a small army of controllers and geologists working on it, and he hoped that sometime in the next 21.5 hours, Mike Collins would be able to spot them with Columbia's navigation sextant. Wherever they were, Armstrong was ready to explore. To the north, a line of boulders broke the rolling smoothness. They looked to be within easy walking distance. Armstrong suspected they had been ejected from some large crater nearby, perhaps that giant crater he had avoided during the descent. They were probably pieces of lunar bedrock. The geologists would undoubtedly want samples. He might even be able to run back to the crater and take some pictures. Armstrong turned his gaze to the LM's small overhead window, and he searched the velvet blackness for stars, but saw only the blue earth. "It's big and bright and beautiful," he told Charlie Duke. Then, after running through the countdown for a simulated lunar liftoff, he and Aldrin turned off most of Eagle's systems. The lander would be dormant until it was time to leave the moon. That would come early tomorrow afternoon, if all went well. Nassau Bay, Texas. Outside the Aldrin house, where it had begun to rain into the muggy afternoon air, a group of reporters assembled on the front lawn. Already they had spoken to Jan Armstrong and Pat Collins about this day's incredible events. Now they wanted Joan Aldrin's reaction. For some time, they waited for her to emerge. Inside, Joan was savoring relief. Buzz had always said that the moment of truth would be the liftoff from the moon. But in her mind, it was the landing. When the powered descent began, Joan was in front of the television, surrounded by family and friends, her emotions under control. She listened intently to the squawk box, but it was hard to hear what Buzz was saying, and when she did, it was so technical that she did not often understand. Fortunately, Jerry Carr and Rusty Schweikert were there to explain what was happening. Then, Eagle was very low, and she could barely stand the tension. Rusty told her that the fuel was now down to a matter of seconds, and that Neil and Buzz had not yet found a place to land. The words overwhelmed her. She stood in the silence of that crowded room, holding onto a doorway, her eyes brimming with tears, and listened to her husband's voice. Finally, in the midst of the numbers, she heard Buzz say, "Okay, engine stop." Those words she understood. They had made it. She found the embrace of Buzz's uncle, Bob Moon, and then headed for her bedroom. By the time the reporters and the TV crews gathered, Joan was on a high. After a time, she went out to them, sheltered from the rain by an umbrella held by a NASA public affairs man. All the times that she had faced the press and dutifully concealed her terror were behind her. She radiated life, and she used this moment as if it had been made for her. Here was a stage to play on. One of the reporters asked, "What were you doing when they landed?" "Well," said Joan in a stage whisper, "I was holding on to the wall. I was praying." The reporters did not pick up on her performance, as they asked the same questions they had already asked the other two wives. "What are your plans for the moonwalk?" "Will you let the children stay up to watch?" she wondered. My God, what is wrong with them? They seemed drained of energy. She would rouse them. "Listen," cried Joan, her eyes wide. "Aren't you all excited?" For a moment she was silent, suddenly in command of her small audience, and then she let loose her jubilation. "They did it! They did it!" 5:11 p.m. It was hard to believe that two men could land on the moon and go to sleep before setting foot on it, but that was what the conservatively minded flight plan called for. In case Armstrong and Aldrin had to make an emergency liftoff and rendezvous, they would need to be rested. Before the mission, Armstrong had approved the early 4-hour sleep period, knowing full well that, barring any problems, he and Aldrin would almost surely reject it on the moon. He wasn't about to say anything to the press. If for some unforeseen reason he and Aldrin ended up sticking to the original plan, they'd write, "Astronauts step on moon 4 hours behind schedule." But now there was no reason to wait. Eagle was in perfect order. 1/6 G felt entirely natural. In fact, they liked it better than either normal gravity or weightlessness. It had much of the buoyancy of zero G without the disorienting lack of up and down, and so Armstrong and Aldrin agreed they would go out early. Armstrong called Houston to suggest that the moonwalk begin at about 8 o'clock in the evening, Houston time, some 5 hours ahead of schedule. Almost immediately, Charlie Duke came back with a go-ahead. "You guys are getting primetime TV," Duke said. 5:57 p.m. In the history of exploration, one of the few moments that could compare with this one came on May 29, 1953, when Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay became the first humans to stand atop the wind-swept summit of Mount Everest. In their brief minutes atop that ultimate peak, Hillary's actions were those of the conqueror. He aimed his camera down each ice-crusted ridge at the lands below and snapped the pictures that would prove to the world they had made it. The Nepalese Sherpa Tenzing, meanwhile, hollowed out a place in the snow and filled it with offerings to his god. For him, the climb was not a conquest, but a pilgrimage. Now it was Buzz Aldrin who enacted a spiritual observance in a strange and distant place. In the weeks before launch, he had searched for some gesture that would be worthy of the moment, and he had decided to celebrate communion. Deke Slayton had warned him against broadcasting any religious observance over the air. NASA was still coping with a controversy stirred by the Genesis reading on Apollo 8. Aldrin's communion would have to be a secret one. Now that it was clear that he and Armstrong were on the moon to stay for a while, Aldrin took advantage of a quiet moment. He opened the stowage pouch that contained his personal mementos and removed a plastic bag containing a small flask of wine, a chalice, and some wafers, and set them on the little fold-down table just beneath the keyboard for the abort guidance computer. He keyed his mic. "This is the LM pilot speaking. I'd like to take this opportunity to ask every person listening in, whoever and wherever they may be, to pause for a moment and contemplate the events of the past few hours, and to give thanks in his or her own way." Armstrong looked on, an expression of faint disdain on his face, as if to say, "What's he up to now?" While Aldrin went on with his ceremony, released in the gentle gravity, the wine poured slowly and curled gracefully against the side of the cup. Aldrin read silently from a small card on which he had printed words from the Book of John. "I am the wine, and you are the branches. Whoever remains in me, and I in him, will bear much fruit, for you can do nothing without me." In Nassau Bay, Joan Aldrin, who had settled into a warm and wonderful state, playing old Duke Ellington records with one ear tuned to the squawk box, marveled when her husband asked for a moment of silence. Though she did not know he was taking communion, she saw it as happy evidence of a hidden dimension. All this time she had suspected Buzz was so caught up in the technical side of his mission that he had missed its significance. But now she realized she had been wrong. If Aldrin's communion marked a very personal observance, then Neil Armstrong had his own ceremony to think about. Almost from the moment the world learned that he would be the first human being to set foot on the moon, he had been asked what he would say as he crossed that threshold. His mail had been full of suggestions, including passages from the Bible, verses of Shakespeare, and countless others. Everyone from the press to the simulator instructors brought it up. Not even by leaving Earth could he escape. Collins and Aldrin asked about it on the way to the moon. If it hadn't been for the fact that everyone made such a big thing of it, Aldrin wouldn't have focused on the matter at all. The landing was the flight's greatest achievement, and in Armstrong's mind, it amounted to the first human contact with the moon. But to a public estranged from the technology of this journey, a landing was less meaningful than a footstep. If it was natural for them to want historic words for historic occasions, they were nevertheless asking them of a man who does not deal liberally in words. But now, on the moon, Armstrong knew he could delay no longer. As he thought about the first step he would take from Eagle's footpad, he pondered the inherent paradox. A small step, yet a significant one. And he knew what he would say. 7:21 p.m. The moon cast its light into Eagle's cabin as Armstrong and Aldrin began the most critical and the most tiring part of the entire moonwalk, suiting up. They were already behind schedule simply because there had been things to do that had never been part of the practice runs, such as stowing the trash from dinner, and they took longer than the men expected. But this was no time to rush, and Armstrong and Aldrin worked with the care of skydivers packing their chutes, following the checklist to the letter. First, they pulled on the lunar overshoes, whose rubber soles had coarse treads designed to give sure footing on alien soil. Next, they strapped on the portable life support system, the massive backpack that had been the bane of their existence during training. On the moon, each one weighed just over 20 pounds. Armstrong and Aldrin had no trouble hefting them with one hand. Still, they felt the mass of the packs. That was undiminished, and despite their efforts to avoid bumping into control panels and each other in the cramped cabin, that happened more than once. Oxygen hoses were next, their metal fittings locked into receptacles on the front of their suits. Then came hoses for their water-cooled underwear. Water from the backpacks would circulate through a network of tiny tubes woven into the undergarment. This method of cooling a man inside a spacesuit was so effective that there was almost no way for him to become overheated, the way Gemini spacewalkers had. Tests had showed that he would tire himself out before that happened. Armstrong and Aldrin carefully locked each hose in place and then locked the locks in yet another level of security. Both men were on hot mic now, and the radio transmissions that came down from the moon sounded like strange high-tech poetry. Locks are checked. Blue locks are checked. Lock locks, red locks, purge locks. Onto each man's clear bubble helmet went a special outer helmet equipped with a gold-plated visor to reflect the sun's unfiltered glare. On their chests, they wore small control units for their radios and to display readings on the backpack. Each methodical step brought them closer to setting foot on the bright ground beyond Eagle's windows. "All set for the gloves," Aldrin said, and each man pulled on a space-age version of a knight's gauntlet, with coverings of woven steel fiber and rubber fingertips that afforded some measure of dexterity. With the flick of a switch, each man started the pumps and fans in his backpack and heard the familiar, reassuring hum of machinery that would keep him alive, and felt the whoosh of oxygen past his face. Their ears registered increasing pressure as the suits inflated to 3.5 pounds per square inch. Now, Armstrong and Aldrin were self-contained, mobile spacecraft. 9:28 p.m. All that remained was to vent Eagle's oxygen into space, but even that took longer than expected. Aldrin opened the valve, and the men watched the pressure reading creep downward. After 3 minutes, it was 0.4 pounds. A minute later, 0.2. "Let me see if it will open now," Aldrin said, reaching for the hatch handle. It stayed firmly shut. The pressure read 0.1 pound and holding. Neither man wanted to tug on the thin metal door for fear of damaging it. Finally, Aldrin peeled back one corner to break the seal. That did it. "The hatch is coming open," Armstrong radioed, excitement creeping into his voice. As it did so, the last wisps of Eagle's atmosphere rushed outward in a flurry of ice particles, and the two men stood in the vacuum of space. While Aldrin held the hatch open, Armstrong sank to his knees and carefully moved his suited bulk through the opening. He moved onto a large platform called the porch, with large handrails on either side that bridged the hatchway with the ladder. When his boots met the top rung, he grasped the handrails and raised himself upright. After 5 days of floating within the confines of a spacecraft, the change in visual scope was profound. The sensation of height, absent in deep space or in orbit, returned to him. Before him, the shadowed, foil-clad bulk of his lunar module. Beyond, a pristine wilderness. He could not descend yet. For one thing, the world was waiting to see the event. Armstrong pulled a D-ring on Eagle's side, and an equipment stowage tray lowered like a drawbridge. On it, a small TV camera began transmitting to Earth, where Cliff Charlesworth and his team of controllers listened and waited. Moments passed, and then Armstrong heard Capcom Bruce McCandless radio, "We're getting a picture on the TV." On the big screen in Mission Control, a strange, almost abstract black-and-white image flickered into existence. The front leg of the lunar module slanted across a tableau of black sky and bright ground, and at the top, the shadowy form of Neil Armstrong descended, one rung at a time, toward the moon. When Armstrong reached the bottom rung, he paused. The legs were designed to compress with the force of landing, bringing the ladder closer to the surface in the process, but Eagle had touched down too gently for that to happen. Armstrong was still more than 3 feet up. For a moment, he dangled his foot in space, then launched himself into a slow-motion fall, landing on both feet inside the foil-covered footpad. Before he went any further, he wanted to be sure he could get back up. He sprang upward and almost missed the bottom rung, but at last managed to steady himself. Satisfied, he descended once more. Standing in deep shadow, Armstrong looked down at the soil just beyond the footpad, and as he had done many times in training, he described what he saw for the benefit of the scientists on Earth. "The surface appears to be very, very fine-grained as you get close to it. It's almost like a powder." In simulations, his voice had been decidedly matter-of-fact. Now it was laced with excited curiosity. Grasping the ladder with an upraised glove, Armstrong turned to his left and leaned outward. "Okay," he said. "I'm going to step off the LM now." Silently, carefully, he raised his left boot over the lip of the footpad and lowered it to the dust. Immediately he tested his weight, bouncing in the gentle gravity, and when he felt firm ground, he was still. One foot on the last vestige of earthly things, the other on the moon. He spoke. "That's one small step for man." Now a pause. "One giant leap for mankind." Footnote. The quote would be forever footnoted. Armstrong would report after the flight that he had intended to say, "one small step for a man," but the indefinite article is definitely missing from the transmission. In 1971, asked by writer Robert Sherrod whether the A had been lost in transmission or simply forgotten, Armstrong, clearly savoring the ambiguity, replied, "We'll never know." To this writer, the cadence of Armstrong's words on tape suggests that the A was forgotten, not lost. Again he tested his weight and was reassured to find that his boot penetrated only a fraction of an inch. Still holding on, he stretched out his toe and dragged it backward several times, furrowing the soft ground. Dust clung like soot to the light blue sole of his boot. Having made this first tentative exploration, Armstrong lowered his right foot and stepped sideways, both hands resting on the big horizontal strut of Eagle's landing gear. And at last, after bouncing up and down a few more times, he let go of Eagle and stood on the moon. Armstrong moved away from the lander with the halting steps of a man learning to walk again. He moved with a shuffling, stiff-legged gait. It was difficult to bend at the knee, and movement came mostly from the ankles and the toes. But he felt buoyant, something between walking and floating. Heavy and light were redefined. His space-suited body, 348 pounds on Earth, now weighed only 58 pounds. It was almost familiar. The simulations were that good, and it was even easier to move around than he had expected. He knew that the first order of business was to collect a small bag of soil called the contingency sample that would serve as the scientist's hedge against an aborted moonwalk. But he would do that in sunlight, and he wanted to take care of getting a Hasselblad down to the surface while his eyes were still adapted to the darkness. This he accomplished with some effort, as he and Aldrin operated a special conveyor line. Then, with the camera mounted on the control unit on his chest, still standing in the lander's shadow, Armstrong snapped the first pictures taken on the surface of another world. But pictures were not supposed to be his first priority, and after a minute, McCandless reminded him about the sample. Aldrin added his own reminder. "Right," Armstrong said quickly, finishing his panorama. Then he reached into a pocket on his thigh and pulled out a collapsible handle with the detachable bag at one end. He moved into sunlight for the first time, the glare penetrating his mirrored visor like a 1,000-watt spotlight. Turning away, Armstrong began to dig into the surface, and what he found surprised him. Everywhere there was the same soft powder, and yet, here and there, he met resistance. He managed to scoop up enough dust to fill the bag, and even managed to snare a couple of small rocks. The geologists, he told himself, would get their money's worth. "That looks beautiful from here, Neil," Aldrin said. He was talking about the sample, but Armstrong responded as if he had meant the moon. "It has a stark beauty all its own," he said, excitement finally invading his voice. It was beautiful. It had the serenity of the high desert of Edwards, only here was the ultimate desert, complete in its stillness and in its starkness. When he turned, he saw the same peculiar transformation from bright tan to ashen gray he'd seen from the LM windows, and when he held the contingency sample in his hand, the mystery of the moon's color deepened. The soil in the bag was almost black, like powdered graphite. Holding the now unneeded collector handle, Armstrong considered throwing it like a javelin, but thought better of it, and instead gave it an underhand toss. It sailed away on a long, lazy trajectory, spinning in slow motion in the sunlight, and traveling an impossibly long distance before landing in the dust. "I didn't know you could throw so far, Neil," joked Aldrin. The man on the surface of the moon answered with a delighted laugh in his voice, "You can really throw things a long way up here." Armstrong was elated, and for good reason. The moon offered him firm ground and good footing, working in 1/6 gravity, in contrast to the grueling training sessions, was easy. Barring a major problem with equipment or with Eagle, the first moonwalk was bound to be as successful as anyone had hoped. 10:10 p.m. "Are you ready for me to come out?" Not a trace of eagerness sounded in Buzz Aldrin's voice, even though he had been watching Armstrong walk on the moon for 14 minutes. Now it was his turn. While Armstrong radioed guidance, he emerged onto the porch. He offered a mild joke about making sure not to lock the hatch on his way out, which got a laugh from his commander. Then, ever methodical, Aldrin made his own descent, describing his progress to Earth. But when he was standing in the footpad, looking out at the moon, his powers of description momentarily left him. He saw disorder, And yet there was a precision, he would say later, the precision of rock and dust. There must be some combination of words that would describe it, but Aldrin could only utter, "Beautiful view." Armstrong agreed. "Isn't that something? Magnificent sight out here." Hearing this, Aldrin suddenly had the words he was looking for. With quiet wonder in his voice, he said, "Magnificent desolation." Holding the ladder with both hands, Aldrin swung both feet out of the footpad and onto the moon. The checklist called for Aldrin to check his balance and stability, and that he did, twirling and leaping like a dancer in slow motion, feeling the strange inertia of his backpack. To compensate for the mass of the pack, he had to lean forward at a seemingly impossible angle. On Earth, he would have fallen over, but the pull of this small world was so mild that he could not easily tell when he was standing exactly upright. Looking into the distance, Aldrin scanned the plains of the Sea of Tranquility. The land curved gently but noticeably away from him, all the way out to the horizon, which was only a mile and a half away. He could actually see that he and Armstrong were standing on a sphere. Aldrin's eyes went to his feet, where a fascinating display of motion took place every time he took a step. Each footfall launched a spray of particles that sailed outward in perfect arcs, unhindered by an atmosphere, all coming to rest roughly the same distance away. Intrigued, he kicked his foot like a child on a playground, sending streams of dust flying gracefully into space. He looked at his own footprints and marveled at their sharpness, as if he had placed his foot in talcum powder, and always he radioed his observations to Earth. And so, two men at the edge of human experience went about their work, their faces hidden by mirrors, their voices so unrevealing that most of the time only people who knew them well could hear the excitement in them. They talked about the mechanical behavior of the soil and the appearance of the rocks, and it was all very technical, all under control. The first men on the moon were not about to indulge in excited exclamations or elaborate statements of wonder, not just because the first lunar landing was so laden with history, but because it was not in their nature. 10:40 p.m. By international agreement, no nation could claim the moon, even one that managed to go there. That was reflected in the plaque on Eagle's front leg, bearing the inscription, "We came in peace for all mankind." But it was the United States that had accomplished the feat, and NASA had decided that the Stars and Stripes would be raised during the moonwalk. Already, Armstrong had mounted the TV camera on a stand about 60 feet from Eagle, where it would broadcast the rest of the activities. Now he and Aldrin unfurled an American flag, stiffened with wire so that it would fly on an airless world, and struggled to plant it in the dust. As hard as they tried, they could push the flagpole only 6 or 8 inches into the ground. For a moment, it seemed the flag would fall over in front of the worldwide audience, but at last the men managed to steady it. Then they backed away. Posing for Armstrong's camera, Aldrin looked at the banner and felt a swell of patriotic pride and humility come over him. He thought of the thousands of people who had helped get it to the moon, and the millions who must be watching him and Armstrong at this moment. He had an almost mystical sense of the unity of humankind, so strong that he felt as if he and Armstrong were not alone. Aldrin marveled at the paradox. No one had ever been farther from Earth, and yet no one had ever been the object of more attention. On the other end of that paradox, an estimated 600 million people, a fifth of the world's population, were indeed watching and listening, the largest audience for any single event in history. Across the United States, it was a hot July evening, and in department stores keeping summer hours, and at moonwalk parties, and in bars suddenly visited with an unaccustomed silence, a fantastic high-tech stage play was unfolding on every working television set. It was a scene of utter stillness, except for two figures who bounded and leaped like snowmen brought to life, with Eagle's spidery form as a backdrop. The picture seemed ghostly, as if it had lost some of its substance crossing the quarter-million-mile distance to Earth. In all, the images from the moon were like a window on a dream. In Nassau Bay, Joan Aldrin watched in quiet amazement. Earlier, when Buzz first appeared, she kicked her feet and blew kisses at the screen. She laughed and felt ready to cry at the same time. As she watched Neil and Buzz move jerkily about, she thought of a silent movie or an old cartoon. It couldn't be real, she thought. And yet, here it was. Men were walking on the moon, and one of them was her husband. But walking, strictly speaking, was not the right word for what Buzz Aldrin was doing now as he took center stage to evaluate the various paces that a person can use traveling on the lunar surface. Aldrin took off on a slow-motion jog, heading for the TV camera. Each step launched him into space, his body suddenly a projectile on a ballistic arc, suspended in mid-stride, until he landed in a spray of powder. Time slowed. He was at the top of the arc waiting to come down. The mass of the backpack required him to anticipate changes in direction well in advance, just as Armstrong had done flying the LM, and as he ran he kept his eyes out 4 or 5 steps ahead, watching for rocks or craters. Now he bounded across the moonscape on 2 feet. So-called kangaroo hop does work, but it seems that your forward mobility is not quite as good as it is in the conventional, more conventional one foot after another. As he ran, he looked like a science fiction version of Edward Muybridge's turn-of-the-century movies of the human figure in motion. Aldrin fully expected that when he was back on Earth, the engineers would use the videotape to make careful measurements of his motions, much as Muybridge had done so long ago, to aid future moonwalkers. Instead, they would be content simply to hear him tell about it. Aldrin was in the middle of his experiments in locomotion when he heard McCandless say, "Neil and Buzz, the President of the United States is in his office now and would like to say a few words to you." Armstrong responded formally, "That would be an honor." Aldrin suddenly felt his heart pound with anticipation. He was taken by surprise. Later he would learn that Armstrong had known the President might call, but had not mentioned it. The two men faced the TV camera and stood still. Moments later they heard Richard Nixon's voice. "Hello, Neil and Buzz. I'm talking to you by telephone from the Oval Room at the White House, and this certainly has to be the most historic telephone call ever made from the White House." Throughout the moonwalk, Aldrin had the slightly discomforting sense of being a part of something bigger than himself. He noticed a kind of detachment from the event, as if he were watching it unfold before him, somehow beyond his control. And it seemed especially so in these moments, standing before the flag, listening to the President. As he listened, he wondered what he might say in response. He decided he would not say anything. For one priceless moment, in the whole history of man, all the people on this earth are truly one. One in their pride in what you have done, and one in our prayers that you will return safely to Earth. There was a silence. And then Armstrong responded, "Thank you, Mr. President. It's a great honor and privilege for us to be here, representing not only the United States, but men of peace of all nations, men with a vision for the future." To some listeners, Armstrong's voice seemed thick with emotion, as if he were on the verge of tears. Years later, Armstrong would say wryly that in answering the President with a few 100 million people listening, he was probably concentrating on trying to say something that made sense. "Thank you very much," Nixon said, "and all of us look forward to seeing you on the Hornet on Thursday." "I look forward to that very much, sir," Aldrin said. The two men raised their gloved hands in salute, then turned away from the camera and went back to work. 10:55 p.m. If Armstrong and Aldrin had climbed back into Eagle at that moment and blasted off to rejoin Collins, their mission would have been accomplished. The flag was up, and there was in Armstrong's pocket a small bag of the moon. He and Aldrin had already demonstrated that future explorers would be able to work in this alien environment. Anything from now on was frosting on the cake. On Earth, this was the point at which many moonwalk parties started to break up. But in Houston, a team of now quite frustrated geologists watched like children looking at a toy store on closed-circuit television. Armstrong would not let them down. He'd been preparing to collect samples when the president called. Now, while Aldrin set about inspecting and photographing Eagle, Armstrong grabbed a long-handled aluminum scoop and began prospecting. There wasn't much time. Armstrong was allowed only about 10 minutes to gather enough rocks and soil to fill one of two aluminum sample containers, or rock boxes. The geologist called this the bulk sample, and it was intended to be a fairly quick grab. Later, he and Aldrin were to spend time carefully collecting and photographing the so-called documented sample. But Armstrong wasn't at all sure what the rest of the moonwalk would bring, and in case he didn't get a chance for the documented sample, he wanted to select as varied a collection now as he could. Aside from the stiffness of his suit, which fought almost every movement, there was 1/6 G to contend with. No matter how careful he was, when he lifted the scoop from the ground, half the contents went sailing away like pieces of styrofoam. Simply getting the sample over to the LM was a real challenge, but Armstrong persevered, and after several minutes the box was full. Now the task was to seal the box, which would preserve the samples in a lunar vacuum for passage to Earth, but that proved to be a struggle, and when he was finished, the entire bulk sample operation had taken longer than planned. Roughly an hour was left in the moonwalk, and there was still the work of setting up the two scientific experiments. Armstrong realized there would not be nearly enough time for all the exploring he wanted to do. Already he realized the moon was far more interesting than he'd expected. As he accompanied Aldrin on an inspection of Eagle, his attention was constantly drawn to another interesting feature. Some of the small craters had at their centers bits of something shiny, with a beautiful metallic luster. He had no idea what they were, but they looked just like blebs of molten solder on a workshop table. He wished he still had the scoop in his hand. Here and there he saw what looked like transparent crystals lying in the dust. The biggest was the size of a walnut. He would have to come back for these things later, during the documented sample, if there was time. 11:39 p.m. The Sea of Tranquility was more rugged than Armstrong had expected, all bumps and hollows, and not an ideal place to set out a pair of scientific instruments. But about 50 feet from Eagle, he and Aldrin managed to find a fairly level spot to deploy a solar-powered seismometer to detect moonquakes and an array of prisms that would serve as a reflector for a laser beam from Earth to help scientists measure the precise distance from the Earth to the moon. But now, as he and Aldrin finished with the experiments, Bruce McCandless had good news. Mission Control was offering a 15-minute extension. It wasn't much, Armstrong knew, but it would surely help. He'd already abandoned thoughts of inspecting the boulders to the north. Like everything else on the moon, they were farther away than he'd thought. So was the giant crater he'd avoided during the descent. He'd fully expected to see its boulder-strewn rim to the east, but it was over the horizon. But there was the smaller crater he'd flown over just before touching down. It was definitely reachable. According to the timeline, he and Aldrin were to start the documented sample now, but Armstrong figured a quick reconnaissance of the crater would be more valuable than the one or two rocks they could pick up in the same amount of time. In any case, he'd already covered his bets with the bulk sample. Without a word to Houston, while Aldrin made his way back to Eagle, Armstrong took off running. Long, loping strides carried Armstrong into the sun's glare to the edge of a pit that looked to be 80 feet across and 15 or 20 feet deep. Eagle was nearly 200 feet away, looking like a scale model. Armstrong wished he could climb down to the crater floor and pick up a piece of lunar bedrock, but he knew he mustn't try. If he got into trouble, Aldrin's helping hands were a long way off. He clicked off a series of pictures, hoping to document on film what he had no time to investigate or even describe. Then he headed back to the LM. Armstrong had been gone for only about 3 minutes, but it was the only real exploring he would have a chance to do. The rest of the moonwalk passed in a rush of activity. There was no time for both men to collaborate on a documented sample. Instead, Mission Control put Aldrin to work hammering a metal tube into the ground to obtain a core sample, a task that proved even more difficult than planting the flag. Meanwhile, Armstrong scurried about with a pair of long-handled tongs in search of rocks that would best represent this locale of the Sea of Tranquility. He wished he had time to collect some of those mysterious shiny blebs he had seen earlier, or one of the clear crystals he had spotted in the soil. He couldn't find any of those things now. Even as he worked, Bruce McCandless was telling him to press on. Time was short. Time, Armstrong would later note, was a strange commodity on the moon. While their mission proceeded with an accuracy of minutes or seconds, he and Aldrin were on a world where a day lasts a month, where time seems to crawl. Looking at this landscape of craters, rocks, and dust, he had the feeling that he was seeing a snapshot of a world in steady state, that if he had been here 100,000 years ago, or if he returned 1,000,000 years from now, he would see basically the same scene. But after 2 hours and 31 minutes, he had barely come to know the place, and yet the knowledge that would emerge made these 2.5 hours precious beyond measure. Monday, July 21st, 12:12 a.m., Houston time. With a loud and welcome noise, oxygen rushed into Eagle's cabin. If the dire predictions about lunar dust catching fire when exposed to oxygen were true, Armstrong wryly mused, then his whole suit was going to burst into flames because he was covered with grime. Neither man was surprised when nothing happened, but when they took off their helmets, they immediately noticed a pungent odor that reminded Armstrong of wet ashes in a fireplace, and to Aldrin smelled just like spent gunpowder. It was the smell of moon dust. Armstrong and Aldrin took pictures of each other's smiling, bearded faces, and of Tranquility Base, now looking very much like an expedition site. Beyond the flag, standing in its frozen wave, was the television camera on its stand, and still farther away were the 2 scientific experiments. Everything is still as a ghost town. The ground near the LM was covered with their footprints, each with its sharply chiseled pattern of treads. There was in them something akin to immortality. Those prints would remain fresh for perhaps 1,000,000 years, subject only to the constant rain of micrometeorites from space. After eating a late dinner, they added to their expedition's legacy, opening the hatch once more to toss out the backpacks and a bag of other unneeded gear. When Armstrong learned from Mission Control that the seismometer had picked up the jolt of the backpacks hitting the surface, he teased, "You can't get away with anything anymore, can you?" After fielding questions on the geology of the area, Armstrong and Aldrin prepared for a rest. Even though they had been up since 5:30 a.m. Houston time, and it was closing in on 3:30 in the morning, they were still keyed up, and Armstrong doubted they'd actually sleep. He also knew that a very full, very critical day lay ahead. The second half of John Kennedy's challenge had yet to be fulfilled. 3. Before this decade is out. In lunar orbit. Every 2 hours, Columbia circled the moon in silent passage with its lone occupant, Mike Collins. The command module was close quarters for 3 men, but with Armstrong and Aldrin gone, it was almost roomy. He'd folded up the center couch and stowed it underneath the left-hand seat, so that now there was a clear aisle from the side hatch to the lower equipment bay. The extra room would be needed in case there was a problem with the docking mechanism, forcing Armstrong and Aldrin to make an emergency spacewalk from the LM to the command module. For now, it gave Collins unaccustomed freedom. He scurried from his couch to the lower equipment bay and back again, checking systems, making navigation sightings, and attending to a host of housekeeping chores. Command module number 107, the spacecraft he had nursed through its checkout at Downey, California, and piloted across nearly 250,000 miles, was purring along without a single malfunction. Collins felt so confident that when one of the command module's cooling circuits grew too cold, he chose not to follow Mission Control's advice to go through a lengthy malfunction procedure. Instead, in his solitude over the far side, some instinct prompted him to see if the machine might cure itself. He checked his switch settings and waited, and the coolant temperature promptly rose to normal. Columbia would give Collins no worry in his 22 hours alone. His anxieties were focused elsewhere, with the 2 men on the surface of the moon. When his crewmates began the powered descent, Collins was listening in, his cookbook of rendezvous scenarios at the ready in case they had to abort. In the final minutes, he heard them grappled with computer alarms and wondered how serious they might be. As Eagle flew onward, Collins was, like everyone else, a spellbound listener. When it was over, he heard Charlie Duke tell Armstrong and Aldrin there were smiling faces in mission control and all over the world, and Collins radioed, "Don't forget one on the command module." But no one, not Armstrong and Aldrin, nor anyone in mission control, knew just where Eagle was. The location would be a helpful, though not essential, piece of information for his computer to have during tomorrow's rendezvous. It fell to Collins to try to find the LM on the surface, using the command module's 28-power sextant. This task was a little like looking down on Manhattan from a height of 69 miles, trying to spot a single Greyhound bus with a pair of binoculars, and all the while moving at 3,700 miles per hour. It would have been pointless to try if not for the command module's computer, which could aim the sextant precisely at any feature under Columbia's path and keep it fixed on the target, compensating for the command module's swift motion. 2 hours after Eagle touched down, Houston had radioed up a set of coordinates, and Collins was at the eyepiece. When he arrived over the landing site, the sextant whirred into position, and Collins searched frantically for a glint of light. Columbia's speed allowed him only about 2 minutes to search any given area within the long ellipse of landing site 2, and the sextant's field of view was so narrow that he could scan only 1 square mile at a time. 2 frantic minutes later, Collins had come up empty. Each time he went around from the far side, Mission Control had a new set of coordinates for him to try, but on his map, one guess was as much as 10 grid squares away from the last. It didn't take Collins long to realize that no one had a handle on the problem. His search continued fruitlessly for the rest of his 22 solo hours. If Collins could not see his crewmates on the surface, he could still hear them, via a special moon-earth-moon relay link set up by Mission Control. For some reason, it went off sometime after the landing, leaving him feeling distinctly left out. As Armstrong and Aldrin prepared to go outside, Collins asked once again to listen in, and Mission Control restored the relay. He'd hoped to be listening when Armstrong set foot on the moon, to finally hear his long-awaited words, but the timing didn't work out. Armstrong was just wriggling through Eagle's hatch when Columbia slipped behind the far side. By the time he reappeared, Armstrong and Aldrin were putting up the flag with 600 million people as witnesses. If, as he suspected, the TV commentators were describing him as a lonely man, they were wrong. He was savoring something as unique as a moonwalk, the experience of the solo moon voyager. Collins moved through a continual succession of sun-drenched lunar day, soft earth light, and unyielding blackness. For 48 minutes out of each orbit, from loss of signal to acquisition of signal, he knew a solitude unprecedented in human history. Before the flight, he had been asked, more times than he could count, whether the thought of being alone in lunar orbit worried him. "No," he had answered, "I like being by myself." To a fighter pilot, it was the essence of flying, alone in your craft, in control of your craft. It was nothing less than the purest form of freedom. There were lonelier places than the far side of the moon, and Collins had seen them. He'd taken an F-86 over the Greenland ice cap in the dead of winter, hundreds of miles from rescue in the event of an emergency, and felt more anxiety than he did right now. His minutes over the far side were his quiet time, a respite from the constant chatter of Mission Control on the radio. He was anything but lonely. Collins would later write of his far side passages, "I am alone now, truly alone, and absolutely isolated from any known life. I am it." If a count were taken, the score would be 3 billion plus 2 over on the other side of the moon, and 1 plus God knows what, on this side. "I feel this powerfully, not as fear or loneliness, but as awareness, anticipation, satisfaction, confidence, almost exultation. I like the feeling." Into the small hours of Monday morning, Mike Collins circled and worked and waited, waited for tomorrow's moment of truth, when the real success of this mission, getting Armstrong and Aldrin back, would hang in the balance. As his crewmates settled in for the night in Eagle, Collins was finishing up his own very long day, covering the windows, turning out the cabin lights, and thinking of his days as an altar boy in the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C., when he used to snuff out the altar candles after a service. Before the flight, he'd thought he might have some misgivings about going to sleep if there were a problem on board, but Columbia was working like a marvel, and he drifted easily into weightless slumber. Monday, July 21st, 12:52 p.m., Houston time, Tranquility Base. Armstrong and Aldrin stood side by side at Eagle's controls, helmets and gloves locked in place. The first launch from another world was 2 minutes away. Armstrong had spent the night perched on the ascent engine cover, but had not slept at all. Aldrin, who had curled up on the floor, had managed only a few hours of fitful dozing. The problem was that the LM was no bedroom. Moonlight flooded the cabin through the translucent window shades. The instrument panel was aglow with luminescent switches and dials. And it was cold. The men hadn't anticipated that with the shades in place and all the systems turned off, there would be no source of heat in the cabin. By the time they realized what was happening, it was too late. There was no way to fix it. The oxygen flowing into their spacesuits only made them colder. They lay in their suits shivering. Hoping the cabin oxygen might be warmer, they took off their helmets. That only let in the high-pitched whine of the LM's coolant pumps. By the time Ron Evans gave the wake-up call, they had given up trying to sleep. They were still too keyed up to be tired, and their thoughts centered on one thing: getting off the moon. The ascent engine, hidden under the can-shaped cover behind them, had only 3,500 pounds of thrust, but that was enough to propel the ascent stage from the lunar surface into orbit. It was another of Apollo's engineering marvels, for it was even simpler in design than the service propulsion system engine. Like the SPS, it burned hypergolics that ignite on contact, eliminating the need for an ignition system. Once the valves opened, fuel would flow into the combustion chamber, and the engine would fire. That would have to happen 2 minutes from now. Before the flight, Neil Armstrong had worried about those valves, and he'd suggested to the engineers that they consider replacing the electrical actuating system with a mechanical one that he or Aldrin could trigger by hand if the normal method failed. The engineers considered and rejected the idea. They had high confidence in the electrical system, and Armstrong knew there were several redundant ways to fire the engine. If necessary, they could bypass the computer. One of those would work. There was no other way to think about it. To Aldrin, the thought of being stranded on the moon forever simply didn't exist. To conjure that dark thought would have been to go against the whole philosophy behind the mission. Everything had been stacked to ensure their survival. And now, as he and Armstrong followed the checklist through the final minutes of their launch countdown, Aldrin assumed that at zero the lunar stillness would yield to the power of a rocket come to life. But inside Columbia, Mike Collins could not be so confident. Lunar orbit seemed remarkably safe compared to the spot Armstrong and Aldrin were in. Perched motionless on the surface with a single rocket engine to get them off, they belonged to the moon. The engine must work, and it must work long enough for Eagle to reach some kind of orbit. Collins was prepared to rescue them if they couldn't make it all the way up to 69 miles. He could drop down to 50,000 feet, but not too much lower than that. Some of the lunar mountains were 20,000 or 30,000 feet high. And now, as he waited for liftoff, Collins could no longer push aside his darkest fears. "My secret terror for the last 6 months," he would later write, "has been leaving them on the moon and returning to Earth alone. Now I am within minutes of finding out the truth of the matter. If they fail to rise from the surface or crash back into it, I am not going to commit suicide. I am coming home forthwith, but I will be a marked man for life, and I know it. almost better not to have the option I enjoy. As Armstrong and Aldrin made their final preparations for leaving the moon, Collins listened and sweated out the most anxious moments of his career. 12:54 p.m. With 45 seconds to go, Armstrong reminded Aldrin of the last actions they would take on the surface of the moon. At 5 seconds, I'm going to get abort stage and engine arm, and you're going to hit proceed. Right, Aldrin said. And that's all, Armstrong added wryly. If everything worked, he and Aldrin would just be along for the ride from the moment of liftoff until they reached orbit. Now, Aldrin began the final countdown. 9, 8, 7, 6, 5. Abort stage. Engine arm. Ascent. Proceed. He pushed the button. For a fraction of a second, there was stillness. And then, suddenly, there was a muffled bang of pyrotechnic bolts, and then a smooth, steady push, like a high-speed elevator, as Eagle ascended from the moon. We're off, Aldrin exulted. Look at that stuff go all over the place. Outside, a spray of gold foil and debris from the descent stage flew away in all directions. The flag toppled to the dust, and the sea of tranquility fell away as Eagle, ascending in an unreal quiet, headed for lunar orbit. 3:54 p.m. For the first time in the flight, Mike Collins let himself believe they were really going to pull it off. He had spent the past 3.5 hours laboriously punching data into his computer, ready to take over if necessary, but his cookbook of emergency rendezvous procedures had gone unneeded. And there, in the eyepiece of his sextant, Collins could see a small black dot. Eagle, climbing up from the crater so steadily that it seemed to be riding up to him on rails. It was the happiest sight of the whole mission. Collins floated back to his couch. Through the rendezvous window, he could see Eagle slowly closing in, its thrusters spitting flame as Armstrong braked for the final approach. Even as he steered Columbia into position for the docking, Collins raced from one window to the other, taking Hasselblad pictures and movies. And as the last steps of the dance were played out, Collins suddenly called out, "I got the Earth coming up behind you. It's fantastic!" Collins captured the sight on film. Eagle, the moon, and the tiny blue and white world. He would always remember the moment all of humanity captured in a single photograph, minus only himself, the photographer. "Get ready for those million-dollar boxes," Armstrong yelled up the tunnel to Collins. As he handled the two weightless containers, snugly zipped into white cloth bags, he could feel the mass of the rocks inside them, and he was careful not to move too quickly as he passed them through to Collins. When they were safely stowed in Columbia, he passed up a small white pouch and told Collins, "If you want to have a look at what the moon looks like, you can open that up and look. Don't open the bag, though." Collins unzipped the pouch and saw a small Teflon bag filled with black soot. Armstrong laughed. "You'd never have guessed, huh?" "What was that bag?" Collins asked. "The contingency sample," Armstrong said. "Any rocks?" "Yes, there's some rocks in it, too. You can feel them, but you can't see them. They're covered with that graphite." And there was plenty of that graphite on their spacesuits. Armstrong thought they looked like chimney sweeps. Before he and Aldrin could rejoin Collins, they tried to vacuum it off, not just to be tidy, but as part of the procedures to prevent moon germs from reaching Earth. With no real vacuum cleaner, they had to use a brush attached to one of the LM's air hoses. As they had suspected, it turned out to be a vain attempt. Lunar grime had worked its way into the fabric. The suits would never be clean again. When the cleanup was done, and all the unneeded gear was piled in the tiny cabin, Armstrong and Aldrin exited to Columbia and closed the hatch. Eagle was now dead weight. Collins flipped a switch, and the ascent stage drifted away. For his part, Collins was glad to get rid of the craft that had been nothing but a worry to him for 6 days. But in Armstrong and Aldrin he noticed a quiet sadness. Without a heat shield, there was no way to bring Eagle home. No museum would ever put it on display. It would linger in lunar orbit while Mission Control monitored each component's final hours of life. Long after it had become a dead ship, Eagle would spiral downward until it crashed, blasting a modest new crater in the dust. Tuesday, July 22nd, just after midnight, Houston time, the SPS engine roared to life, and 3 minutes later, Armstrong, Aldrin, and Collins were on their way home. The burn was as flawless as the one that had put them in lunar orbit 2 days before, and in the middle of shutting down systems and reading trajectory data off the computer, Mike Collins spoke for all of them. "Beautiful burn, SPS. I love you. You are a jewel. Whoosh!" Thursday, July 24th, 1:16 p.m., Houston time, aboard the carrier Hornet. Armstrong, Aldrin, and Collins stepped out of the helicopter onto the lower deck of the carrier Hornet, looking like men from another world. Outfitted from head to toe in gray-colored biological isolation garments, they peered through face masks, clouded with perspiration, and waved to a crowd of sailors and visiting dignitaries whom they saw only dimly. Despite rubbery legs unaccustomed to Earth's gravity, they made their way quickly to the open door of the silvery quarantine trailer. A NASA doctor followed them and closed the thick windowed door behind them. 3.5 days later, they arrived in Houston, sealed within the trailer, as if they themselves were lunar samples. For the next 2 weeks, they lived within the lunar receiving laboratory, recounting all aspects of the flight in minute detail. Aldrin described the strange flashes he had seen on the way to and from the moon. No one had an explanation, but after a time, Aldrin noticed that Armstrong seemed annoyed whenever the subject came up. As the days passed, the men joked about being jailed, and at the close of one debriefing session, they called out to the engineers on the other side of the glass, "You know where to find us. We're not going anywhere." In the off hours, there were movies, like Goodbye Columbus, and card games. Collins beat Armstrong repeatedly at gin rummy. They had company, including doctors, a NASA public affairs officer, and some unexpected arrivals, a few scientists who were accidentally exposed to lunar samples. And though the LRL wasn't a bad place, it had a bar and an exercise room, time dragged. At the end of one debriefing, when asked, "Any other comments?" Collins said quietly, "I want out." That would come on a hot August night, when the men would be released into a world changed, for at least a time, by what they had done. Armstrong hoped that the first lunar landing would inspire people to believe that seemingly impossible problems could be solved. As for its impact on their own lives, neither Armstrong nor his crewmates could guess what lay ahead. Until now, they hadn't had time to think about it. But there would be months on the banquet circuit, including a world tour. Then each man would find his way into a new life. For now, sitting in the LRL, Buzz Aldrin had time to ponder the significance of what he and his crewmates had been a part of. Back on the Hornet, they had watched videotapes of the news coverage of Apollo 11. There was Walter Cronkite, exulting at the lunar touchdown. Then awed crowds gathered around TV sets, witnessing the first footsteps on another world. For the first time, Aldrin sensed the emotional impact of the first lunar landing. For a man attuned to irony, here was something worth pondering. While the three of them were 250,000 miles away, much of humanity had been spellbound by a midsummer miracle. What a moment that must have been. Aldrin turned to Armstrong and said, "Neil, we missed the whole thing." Book 2. Chapter 6. Sailors on the Ocean of Storms. Apollo 12. 1. The Education of Alan Bean. When the men of Apollo 11 got out of quarantine, Richard Nixon had them and a few hundred guests out to Los Angeles to celebrate. By all accounts, it was a hell of a party. Sometime well into the evening, one of the other astronauts in attendance, by now more than a little drunk, raised his glass. "Here's to the Apollo program," he said heartily. "It's all over." In a sense, he was right. John Kennedy's challenge to land a man on the moon and return him safely to the Earth, the goal that had steered NASA for 8 years, had been met. But was Apollo's mission over? Was the lunar landing simply an engineering demonstration, like the first flight across the Atlantic? There were those who thought so, even some within NASA. Kennedy had said nothing about a second lunar landing, or a third. You wouldn't ask Lindbergh to fly the Atlantic again, they said. Why go back to the moon? But in the summer of 1969, Apollo was only part of a much bigger question. The future of the space program as a whole was undecided. When Richard Nixon took office, the agency had tried to gain early support for a manned space station in Earth orbit, but the president deferred the matter by creating a space task group to formulate recommendations for NASA's future. By July, NASA Administrator Tom Paine was working with the STG on a plan that picked up where John Kennedy had left off. Paine, like his NASA colleagues, believed that there was something implicit in Kennedy's challenge beyond its words, that it was a call for the United States to become a space-faring nation. Apollo had given the country the technology to go to other worlds. It had only to exploit that capability. At NASA headquarters, George Mueller and other planners had put together a far-reaching plan that Paine made even more ambitious in adapting it for the STG. The task group's timetable called for a 12-man space station and a reusable space shuttle as early as 1975, depending on funding. By 1980, the station would have grown into a 50-man space base. 5 years later, there would be 100 men in orbit. Meanwhile, there would be a base in lunar orbit by 1976, with a base on the lunar surface 2 years later. Then, as early as 1981, the first manned expedition to Mars would depart from Earth orbit. The plan was extraordinary, but it was not new. Almost 20 years earlier, the same basic scenario had been mapped out in the pages of Collier's magazine by Wernher von Braun and other space experts. At the time, von Braun was criticized for trying to sell the public a science fiction vision of the future. In the summer of 1969, Paine was trying to turn von Braun's vision into reality. Like everyone at NASA, Paine hoped that the spectacular success of Apollo 11 would create a groundswell of support in the White House and in Congress to propel the space program onward and upward. Fortunately, Vice President Agnew, the chairman of the STG, was extremely enthusiastic, especially about the missions to Mars. The group's report would be ready for presentation to the White House in September, but already there were signs it would not be well received. Since 1965, the year Apollo funding reached its peak, NASA's budget had steadily declined. Nixon staffers had told the agency that this trend would continue and had indicated that even the first building block in the STG plan, the Earth Orbit Space Station, would be a tough sell. Meanwhile, Apollo moved on. Jim Webb had needed all his persuasive abilities to convince Congress and the Bureau of the Budget to pay for enough Saturn V's to fly missions through Apollo 20. He had done so on the premise that no one knew how many flights would be necessary to meet Kennedy's challenge. Now that the first lunar landing had been accomplished sooner than anyone expected, there was enough hardware to fly 9 more lunar landings.